Chapter 27. Foreign Markets. Kyra stood at the railing, seeing a foreign cityscape for the first time. The day was warm and bright with sunshine, and the light fog that had hung over the harbor on their approach in the early morning had burned off, leaving a blue sky filled with a scattering of gray-white clouds and the cries of thousands of seagulls. The weather had warmed in the 4 days since they had set their course south from Acardia. While the chill of late autumn was icing the air above Kyrus's homeland, it seemed much like a fine spring day in the waters of Ganad Bay, the gateway to the free city of Marker's Point. Marker's Point was a small series of islands in the shape of a crescent moon, with the open side facing to the east. The separation of the islands varied with the tides, with interconnections between many of them appearing at low tide, only to disappear upon the tide's return. Aside from the main passage in from the east, there was no draft deep enough for sea-going vessels between any of the islands. The whole of the landmass was populated aside from the short, craggy volcanic mountains that predominated the outer side of the crescent. Much had been built out into the shallow waters of Ganad Bay itself as well, with buildings supported on stilts to keep the floors above high tide. In the early days of seafaring exploration, the once barren island formation had served as a waypoint for voyages across the great expanses between continents. Initially used as a navigation aid, a landmark in an otherwise sparse area of the Katamic, ships would occasionally take shelter in the calm waters of the bay to anchor for repairs or to wait out storms. Eventually, the explorers of the early seafaring age gave way to the second wave, merchants. It became apparent to anyone of a mercantile bent that the island chain made an ideal trading post for the various nautically inclined peoples whose shores touched the Katamic. It was not long before it was settled by various shipping and trading concerns. Many were more than willing to cut half the time off their journey to get paid for their wares at Marker's Point instead of their final destination, even if it meant taking a smaller cut. More voyages in more familiar waters made profits quicker and safer than longer voyages across open sea. Thus, the city of Marker's Point had grown up to be inhabited by money changers and warehouse owners, shippers and fishermen, fugitives and itinerant sailors, tavern keepers, pirates and whores. Few were born in the city, at least outside the brothels, and few spent their whole lives in it. Those hardy few formed the backbone of the island's society, though. The Lord Pon-Eric Halahari and his family, the tide's watchmen who patrolled the waters and kept order, and the Juan family, whose bank financed most of the major deals in the city. Kyrus had never seen such a place before, and had only heard it referred to in storybooks and tavern tales as a place of mystery and intrigue, where deals were made in shady dockside saloons and pirates walk the piers. I suppose the latter is true at least, or will be once they let us dock. They had been under surveillance by one of the three massive lighthouses that surrounded the islands ever since the fog had cleared. Shortly thereafter, a small single-sailed harbor vessel had intercepted them, and one of the tide's watchmen had come aboard. Kyrus had been expecting trouble, considering that they were, after all, pirates. However, the watchman cleared them once he was satisfied that the ship was no longer a part of the Acardian Navy. There were few rules that the pointers enforced, but no naval vessels was one they clung to dearly. It was an unpopular rule among the kingdoms whose subjects might flee to the city, but they felt it was essential to keep trade flowing freely, and they had enough cannons to enforce their decree. Once the watchmen had Captain Zane's word on their lack of affiliation with Acardia, they issued a reminder that open gun ports in the bay were forbidden. After that, the small harbor ship merely escorted them toward the docks. Kyrus watched the shore as they neared the berth they had been assigned. The city was vast, sprawling, built entirely around the periphery of the bay, and filling any surface that could conceivably support a structure. It would only take a few minutes to walk from the inside beach to the outside beach in most parts of Marker's Point, yet to walk one end to the other might require overnight accommodations. Ferries ran crisscross between various docks along the inside face of the city at all hours of the day and night. Kyrus's eyes were drawn up as well, as many of the buildings were tall, spindly affairs, made from imported stone and winding their way up into the sky to make the most of the scant land available. Kyrus could only begin to guess how many people lived in the city. Golis was the largest city in Acardia and held over 50,000. He might have supposed Marker's Point was thrice that at least. Kyrus could recall the sights and sounds of Cadrus from his dreams, a city the size of Marker's Point and Gennad Bay combined, but the visceral feel of approaching it was like nothing his dreams could prepare him for. They had not even reached the dock when the clamor of the throngs on the dock reached them. Ships were being loaded and unloaded, with longshoremen shouting at one another in a dozen languages. Trading ships came and went in the harbor, with smaller boats darting in and around them, containing fishermen, city officials, peddlers who rowed from ship to ship, pressing their wares on newcomers before they even reached port, and countless others whose occupations Kyrus could not gather upon cursory examination. The men of Captain Zane's crew were nearly all on deck, waiting for their chance at shore leave. Not all would be granted the privilege, as men were needed to guard the ship. Kyrus could not imagine why, but most would be making for the city proper with all haste. Scar Harbor was a large enough city by most standards, but the stuffy, parochial attitudes of the locals kept much of interest from happening beyond the dock ward. Kyrus expected that he would be allowed to leave and take in the sights. Captain Zane had granted him 2 full shares of loot, so he was obviously not quite subject to the same rules as the rest of the crew. "After all, he knows my secret, and he saw what I did on the docks at Acardia. It's not as if I would disappear into the city and hide away." Under Captain Zane's expert hand, the former Harbinger, which had yet to be renamed, slid smoothly into its assigned berth. There was a flurry of activity as sails were furled and lines pulled. Men down on the pier shouted up and requested mooring lines be thrown down. Kyrus could hardly contain the wide, childlike grin that was spreading itself over his face. He had never been much of anywhere in his life, and now here he was in Marker's Point. Denric steered the ship into port easily. Even with years between him and the last time he had piloted a ship, and with the unfamiliar feel of his new vessel, the mild waters of Gennad Bay made for easy practice. "Welcome to freedom, lads," Denric called out to the crew, to a general cheer. Stalyart took over the details, directing the flow of the frenzied work on the deck as experienced sailors made ship ready to moor. The green ones had the sense at least to stay out of the way, even Ander, and the work went quickly, even with the short crew. "Eager to be ashore," Denric thought. "I suppose I can understand why. Were it up to me, I would never set foot on dry land again. I did my time in the dirt on that forsaken rock of Relis Island. We need crew, though, and this is the place to find them." Denric made his way down to where his men were laying the gangplank. Before any of his men made it down, though, first there was someone who insisted on coming up. "Who is the captain here?" the man asked. He was a man of perhaps 30 years by his lack of gray hairs, but a hard 30. He bore a pair of scars down the right side of his face, yet had been spared the loss of that eye. He walked with a cane, which thumped hollowly on the deck of the ship as he approached Denric on a hunch. The man was clad in the blue and green livery of the Tide's Watch, but the heavy gold medallion hanging from his neck marked him as a harbor master. "I am Captain Denric Zane. This is my ship," Denric informed the harbor master proudly. There were times to conceal one's identity as a pirate, and other times to wear one's name as a badge of honor. This counted as the latter. "Well, the rumors are true, I see. I had heard the scuttlebutt that you had been among a group of escapees from the New Hope colony. This is quite a fine vessel you have acquired. I must admit, we were skeptical when we saw the Harbinger approach. Our record shows that the Harbinger is registered to the Acardian Navy. When you did not fly your Accardian colors, however, we suspected something amiss. I trust that this vessel and the Accardian Navy are no longer associated? The harbor master left the implied question hanging, waiting for Denric to explain himself. That it says Harbinger on the side is clearly an error. I intend to see it corrected before we shove off, Denric said, crossing his arms in front of him. It is now my duty to ask you, how long would that be? The harbor master asked. 2 days, maybe four, maybe a week. I am in need of a crew, and it will take how long it takes gathering a good one, Denric replied. He would rather have gotten in and out of Marker's Point in a day or two, but he knew better than to take just any man who volunteered. He would interview men and find out what ships they had served on, who their captain had been, and what other skills they possessed. Sailing with the Pirate King ought to carry some prestige, and he hoped to attract the best crew he could lay hands on. Well, we will require an advance of a week's berthing fees. If you depart beforehand, one of the harbor masters will be sure to reimburse you for the unused days remaining. The 7 days will cost you 56,000 zimbals, the harbor master said. Men nearby gasped in shock at the expense, but that was mostly because they did not understand just how worthless a zimbal was. Those who had been to Marker's Point before, or who had traveled to Feru Maru, where zimbals were the legal tender, expected to pay as many as 100 zimbals for a pint of watery ale. Denric paid the man in trade bars equivalent to the barrel of zimbals he had requested. He was not at all certain he had gotten a good exchange rate on them, but this was port and he was a pirate. There was a certain cachet attached to being able to ignore the minor details in financial transactions such as this. He was out to find himself a crew, and being found to count zimbals was not going to help his reputation. A captain hard on his luck was not a man would-be pirates wanted to sail with. When the harbor master had been satisfied, the gangway was clear and the men started pouring off the ship, jostling and shoving to get down first. He noted with a lack of surprise that Mr. Hinterdale was off to the side, waiting out the press of bodies. Mr. Stephen, Denric pulled the young man aside as he brushed by his captain on his way to the gangplank. Aye, Captain, the boy said, looking confused. He had been just paces shy of total freedom before getting waylaid by Captain Zane. I want you to stick by Mr. Hinterdale today and see that he stays out of trouble, Denric ordered. Stephen cocked his head and gave him a puzzled expression. Aye, sir, of course. You don't mind me ask, but what trouble? I hear he'd take half the crew off the old ship and burn another, Stephen said. Rumors had passed to every man on the ship about Kyrus's exploits on the night of the liberation of the Harbinger. Accounts varied, as they always did, in the retelling, but all accounts gave the very clear impression that Mr. Hinterdale was rather capable of looking after himself. Oh, our wizard may be all that, but he is an easy mark here nonetheless. You speak all the languages around here, true? Denric asked, and Stephen nodded in the affirmative. Well, that lad there speaks Accardian, and probably nothing else. He's going to lose all his money and very likely cross someone with a short temper, a sharp blade, and poor social skills today. This place is thick with them. By the waves, it is why we are here. I need those sorts to make pirates of. Now you just stay close to him and be his guide for today, Denric said, looking into Stephen's eyes to make sure the boy knew he was serious. What if he don't want me with him? Stephen asked. I gotta sneak and watch him? The boy raised an eyebrow skeptically. I would not worry over much about that. The lad has never been away from home before. I doubt very much he relishes being on his own anyway, Denric said. Kyrus had watched as Captain Zane had negotiated some sort of payment with the harbor officials, but could not understand a word of it. The harbor master was speaking something that he could only guess was the language of Feru Maru. After that, the men stampeded for the gangplank, an activity Kyrus saw no reason to put his life at risk for, with only the gain of a minute or so to be had for it. As the crowd thinned, leaving only the handful who would stay behind on guard duty, Kairos made his way down himself. He held his arms out to the side to balance himself as the gangplank swayed slightly under his footsteps. When he reached the pier, he turned back to look at the ship. He had yet to get a good look at it since they had boarded it at night, and he had been on it ever since. It was an elegant vessel in Kairos's eyes, well cared for and lovingly detailed, obviously built by shipwrights with a sense of pride. A hand on his shoulder caused Kairos to twist around suddenly. He found that the hand belonged to the exotic young sailor, Stephen. "Oh, that was just you," Kairos, feeling relieved. "Captain said I go with you. You don't speak the tongues here," Stephen told him, nodding. Stephen then pressed a sword belt into his hands, which he had been carrying in the hand that was not on Kairos's shoulder. "And you do speak all the languages they speak here?" Kairos asked, skeptical. "You think I speak Akkadian first?" Stephen asked, smiling lopsidedly. "But no, I not speak every tongue here. They speak everything here, but I speak a lot, see?" "Well, thank you, I suppose. Are you sure you don't mind acting as my interpreter?" Kairos asked. "Don't matter. Captain says," Stephen shrugged. "Captain says clean deck, I clean deck. Captain says haul anchor, I haul anchor. Today, Captain says follow Mr. Hinterdale." "I suppose. What is this for, then?" Kairos held up the sword belt. It was one of the ones they had brought with them on the initial raid on the Harbinger. A saber, Kairos believed. "Less trouble with you carrying a sword, hm? Lot of rough guys round this place. See an easy mark, they get ya," Stephen said. Kairos left it at that and buckled on the belt. The weight of the sword felt oddly reassuring at his side, though it was awkward bouncing against his leg, and he could feel the offset weight of the belt already starting to cause it to chafe against his side after the first few paces. Kairos tried resting his hand on the hilt to steady the blade and lessen the discomfort. Preoccupied as he was with figuring out how to wear the sword, he momentarily forgot about Stephen as the younger man had fallen into step behind him. As they left the pier where the Harbinger was moored, slap! Kairos withdrew the stinging hand from the sword hilt and snapped his head around to see what had just happened. "Stop that! You look like you never used sword before," Stephen chided him, giving him a stern look. Kairos looked the lad up and down. He was wiry of build with exotic yellow-orange skin and a mop of blonde hair that he kept shaven at the sides. His arms, exposed now that the weather was warm enough for rolled sleeves, were covered in tattoos of dragons, serpents, knives, and the like. Around his neck was a pendant that Kairos thought he recognized as a Keshi totem for invoking bad luck on one's enemies. It seemed that Stephen knew his tricks when it came to not looking like an easy mark. The tattoos in particular were something that Kairos had been wondering about. Ever since the warm turn of weather as they sailed southward, the crew had more and more taken to rolling up sleeves or working bare-chested up on the main deck. As a result, Kairos had seen a collage of human-based artwork. Nearly every man aboard seemed to bear some sort of marking. Some had fearsome collections of beasts and omens inscribed on their bodies to make themselves appear more dangerous, or, as Kairos occasionally considered, properly identify themselves as dangerous. Names and mottos were commonplace as well, with men paying tribute to lovers or parents, lost brothers or devoted friends, or expressing the values they live by. Nothing says a man loves gold, rum, and whores like a tattoo that says gold and rum and whores. A few others had patterns that seemed to be strictly decorative, with no deeper meaning. It finally occurred to Kairos that he had never seen a tattoo in his dreams of Vaedrus. Brannis and his contemporaries were unfamiliar with them. The ogre tribes often painted their bodies for war and rituals, but nothing like the permanent, subcutaneous markings that were so common in Tellurac. "Stephen, where can I find a place to get a tattoo like yours?" Kairos asked.
"Ah, now you thinking. No hand on sword. Get tattoo. You be scary guys soon, huh?"
Stephen smiled at him. "Something like that," Kairos replied. He had something different in mind, though. The tattoo den was nestled in a corner of an open-air market, one of the fixed structures that surrounded a plaza filled with carts and booths. Kairos had been following Stephen around what felt like half the island chain. The interior was dimly lit by a pair of braziers that were burning some sort of incense. It gave a reddish glow to everything in the parlor. The walls were covered in exotic artwork, masks, little carved wooden reliefs, scrolls with strange symbols similar to runes but which Kairos thought might be Keshi script, and tassels with bells on them. There was a low couch to one side of the room with a chair next to it, surrounded by tables with various implements whose purpose Kairos could surmise with some trepidation. Seated in the chair was a wrinkled old man whose bald head, and most of his body, was a mess of intermingled tattoos. The man had a pinched face and puckered mouth, an impression heightened by the long, thin pipe he was puffing at, jetting out little purple-gray wisps of smoke. A pair of tiny round spectacles perched on his nose, and he stared through them at the thin book, a soft-covered piece of trash that was likely made by typesetters, Kairos thought disdainfully, whose front cover he had curled around the back to allow it to stay open when held with one hand. Bells had clattered and jingled from the top of the door as Kairos and Stephen had entered, yet the old man had not stirred from his book. The whole of the parlor smelled of the combined smokes of the braziers and the old man's pipe, a cloying, sickly sweet scent that stung the eyes until they became accustomed to it. Stephen called something out in a language Kairos did not understand. Based on his guess about the symbols on the walls, he supposed that the lad was using Keshi. Stephen seemed to be very polite in addressing the older man, which he gathered meant Stephen respected him more than Kairos. I suppose either he was just raised to respect his elders, or he figures that Captain Zane sent him as my nanny for the day. How much respect should I deserve? What are you saying to him? Kairos asked, after the two appeared to be holding a conversation rather than making the pleasantries of a greeting as a prelude to a business transaction. Oh, I know him long time, Stephen said. I grow up Marcus Point. He a good guy. You can trust him. Does he speak Akkadian? Kairos asked. What he had in mind would be a lot easier if he could communicate with the old man directly. No, speak Keshi, Stephen said, confirming Kairos's conjecture about the language at least, unhelpful though the information was. Stephen then launched into Keshi speech at length with the old man, then took Kairos by the hands and arranged them such that Kairos's hands were palm up, spread in front of him. Tell him name now, he prompted Kairos. Kairos Hinterdale, Kairos said dutifully, presumably a sort of formal introduction. Something Keshi, Shao, the old man replied, finally setting down the book and mirroring Kairos's spread palms gesture. Grandfather Shao take care of you, Stephen nodded at Kairos. Ask him if he can copy from a design I draw, Kairos said. Stephen relayed the message. Grandfather Shao carried on at length before stopping to let Stephen translate back. He says, yeah, just draw it and he put it anywhere you want, Stephen said. That sounded like a lot more than what you translated, Kairos said. He's a proud old man. He say a lot you don't care about. I tell you the good stuff, Stephen assured him. Find out how much it will cost, Kairos ordered. Again, Stephen launched into a conversation that sounded like it included a lot more than his initial request. 6,000 zimbles. I get you good deal, Stephen said, and Kairos agreed. Unlike much of the crew, the math behind just how little each zimble was worth was not so difficult for him. It would have been about the price of a meal at a nicer tavern.
He think you not draw too much. You draw all day, he make you pay more, yeah?
Well, I can deal with that when the time comes, Kairos said. Can you ask him for something to draw on? A few minutes later, Kairos was working on the design for the tattoo he wanted. Stephen seemed like he was not the type for waiting and started getting restless after not terribly long. Grandfather Shao had initially showed some slight interest in what Kairos was starting to draw, but seeing that he did not recognize the design, he went back to his book. "Stephen, I think I will be fine here, if you wish to enjoy the markets. I do not think I will get into any trouble here," Kairos assured the lad. "You not have tell me twice." Stephen winked and ducked out of the parlor in a clamor of bells before Kairos could say another word. Kairos worked for a few minutes, double then triple checking his work. His final check was less obvious, but the design seemed to hold up to all scrutiny. It held the tiny bit of ether he released into it. He got Grandfather Shao's attention and showed him the design, a vertical series of runes nearly identical to the ones he had carved into the door of his cabin. The old man examined it critically, nodding slightly, then looked at Kairos and raised an eyebrow eloquently, glancing over Kairos. Kairos took the hint and worked his way out of his tunic. He described an area of his upper left arm by pointing and outlining with his finger. Grandfather Shao nodded again, seeming satisfied. He gestured Kairos to recline on the couch and then dragged his chair around to where Kairos's shoulder was. He took the paper from Kairos and turned it this way and that, until Kairos took hold of it and lined it up on his shoulder right where he wanted it. Then Shao took his thumb and forefinger and held them together, then widened them, then narrowed them, and cocked his head and raised an eyebrow. "Just like it is there," Kairos pointed emphatically to the drawn version he had done. He had already accounted for the proper size. Grandfather Shao nodded sagely. The old man went to a cupboard in the back of the shop and gathered some glasses and jars contained therein. He poured a glass of something that smelled strongly of alcohol, but had not but a bit of yellow in it to keep it from being completely clear. The old man daubed a cloth in it and wiped the area clean where he was about to work. Then he poured a second glass of another liquid and handed it to Kairos. Shao made a quick motion with his wrist, which Kairos mimicked with the hand not holding the glass, trying to confirm whether he was meant to drink it. "If you say so," Kairos muttered, and downed the contents. It burned all the way down and back up when he exhaled afterward. While he was certain he had actually swallowed it, the fumes cleared his nose and made his eyes water. "You could warn a fellow," Kairos protested. The old man chuckled. "You do not speak Akkadian, do you?" Kairos asked. Grandfather Shao held out one hand and wobbled it side to side and shrugged. "Maybe little," he admitted, and the two of them shared a chuckle. Kairos winced as the first needle pierced his skin, and several times throughout the ordeal, Grandfather Shao had stopped his work to cuff him on the side of the head and lay into him in a string of invectives in Keshi that, despite the language barrier, clearly called into question his manhood. It seemed like a day, and in truth had taken hours, but at the end, like so many things, it was done. The whole of his left shoulder felt bee-stung, but Kairos looked at the result and compared it to the paper copy he had made. If Kairos had been an expert scrivener, then Grandfather Shao had every right to be called an expert tattooist. The markings matched identically, with not a line out of place or a proportion amiss. The true test was in practice, and Kairos drew ether. Watching in his now habitual split ether vision, he directed it into the ward that Grandfather Shao had carved into his arm. It glowed in the ether, just like his cabin door had, and a grin spread widely across his face. Grandfather Shao assumed that he was just especially pleased with the work, and he smiled in return. "Can you keep a secret?" Kairos asked, but Shao just looked at him quizzically. "Well, let me show you something anyway." Kairos slowly and carefully drew the cutlass from its scabbard, turning away from Shao lest he feel threatened. With equal care, he pressed the blade against his forearm, gently at first, and when he saw no sign of duress from the ward, pressed firmly. When that showed no sign of affecting the ward either, he pulled back the blade and swung it lightly into his arm. Again the ward held. Grandfather Shao's eyes were wide. He rambled something in Keshi that Kairos could not understand, but seemed rather shocked. Kairos just slid the blade back into its scabbard and pointed to the markings on his arm, which Shao had just tattooed there. Shao just pointed to himself in confusion, incredulous that he was being credited with the result he had just seen. Kairos caught the old man's eye straying to the drawing on the table, where he had left it after confirming it was an accurate copy. Kairos could see gold reflected in those eyes, which he could understand, even if Shao could not understand that without the knowledge of how to activate it, the ward would be nothing but decoration. To save Shao some trouble in his future, Kairos reached over and picked up the drawing. He raised his own eyebrows in imitation of Shao's own gesture and smiled. Then he incinerated the drawing with a quick jolt of ether, sending it to the floor and ceiling, half smoke, half ash, letting go of it just in time to avoid burning himself badly. "Sorry," Kairos said. "I hope this will make up for it." He pulled a trade bar from his pocket and handed it to the old man. It was worth 20 times the price he had been asked. "Thank you," Kairos told Grandfather Shao as he stood to leave, gathering his tunic and pulling it over his head.
"Thanks you," Grandfather Shao replied, wide-eyed.
Kairos had a swagger in his step as he wandered the marketplace. He had just put Cadran Ward's and Accardian, or in this case, Marker's Point, tattooing together in a way that he felt was sure to protect him from anything that he was likely to get stuck, slashed, or run through with in the marketplace. He was feeling rightly proud of himself as he casually browsed the wares offered from all across Tellurac. It actually reminded him a lot of the day that the trading ship's merchants had set up shop in Accardia. He wished Abelay could have been there to see all the bizarre sights of Marker's Point's much larger version. It somehow seemed more authentic here, without the backdrop of Kairos's hometown, making everything seem safe and compartmentalized. Here there was no scrivener's shop to go home to, just a pirate ship. He wondered what expert Davin would think of him, signing on with Captain Zane.
"I hope he would be able to see the extenuating circumstances. I mean, I was going to be executed, and Captain Zane and that big fellow Tommond came and helped me break out of jail."
While every marketplace had food, drink, and various cloth and baubles, Marker's Point seemed to go well beyond those hawkers' staples. One stall was set up with displays of wicker baskets, each containing a deadly venomous snake. Blades were widely sold, mainly the small, easily concealed type. Though all were considered contraband in Accardia, here there was mind root, red-leafed clover, rue spider venom, kokoi grass, furbat fur, dammy juice, and lich berries, all sold openly. Kairos could not even remember which among them were deadly poisons and which were recreational hallucinogens. Kairos kept one eye to seeing if he could spot Steven again, but generally he just enjoyed browsing among the various transient merchants who had set up shop for a week, a season, or longer, depending on how quickly they ran out of the wares they had brought from their homelands. He stopped at the more permanent structures as well, mostly run by trading houses and long-standing traders who had goods shipped to Marker's Point just to resell them. It was slow going for a while, until Kairos learned that with enough persistence, he could usually find someone who spoke enough Accardian to help make a deal. By the time the sun had gone down, Kairos had cleared quite a lot of space in his pockets. He had purchased an entire new set of clothing that fit him properly. He wore a new set of low-cut boots that the shopkeeper who he bought them from insisted would help him keep his footing on the deck of a ship. He also found a shop that had a comb made from a seashell, a material that Kairos was rather indifferent to, just wanting to get a comb of any sort, and purchased that as well. Somewhere along the way, he also bought a rucksack, as his awkward bundle was beginning to worry him. At what he best thought was dinner time by the ache in his stomach, Kairos tried eel on a stick for the first time, though possibly for the only time, as it was not terribly tasty. An impulse purchase of salt, pepper, and something nice-smelling called roche rounded out his shopping trip. As Kyrus wended his way back toward where the Harbinger was moored, he found a place with an unbroken view to the west to watch the colors in the sky change. He had never seen the sunset over the water before. Scar Harbor only saw sunrises. The pinks and reds were supposed to mean something about the weather the next day, but Kyrus did not care about that. He just stopped to enjoy the colors over the water, again wishing that he had Abelay to watch it with. Night had fully fallen well before Kyrus got halfway back to the ship. He continued along in a circular fashion, keeping the bay to his right hand as best he could manage. There was nothing quite resembling a main thoroughfare in the whole of the city, just an endless web of interwoven streets and alleys. The roads were often lit by lanterns, but many could only be followed by starlight. Even as late as it was, there were the noises of taverns and brothels, keeping the night from seeming either peaceful or eerie, merely seedy. Kyrus had learned a few tricks of getting bearings by the night sky during Stalyard's first few lessons on navigation, and he used them when he was unsure whether he was still proceeding in the right direction. At one desolate intersection, when he stopped to look up, he heard a voice that he could only surmise was addressing him. "You lost, kid," he heard from the shadows of a nearby building. The voice spoke Akkadian like a native, but did not sound friendly toward its countrymen. Kyrus thought better of answering and just made a hasty decision about direction and got moving.
"Hey now, no reason to be running off like that," another voice joined in from an alley he was passing by. "This is our territory here, and at night, there's a fee for passing through it." The first voice came again, and this time Kyrus could make out a figure approaching him.
Correction, several figures,
Kyrus realized as the friends of the first voice came out of hiding. Kyrus realized he had let his ether vision slip during his time admiring the offerings in the marketplace, and he fixed his vision back into its hybrid view. Instantly, the night came alive in Kyrus' sight. While the roads and alleys were as much of a mystery as before, his antagonists came into clear focus. There were 11 of them, which was a larger number than Kyrus had hoped for, and it seemed that they had all the routes of escape manned. "I shall pay no fee. I will just be on my way," Kyrus said to no one in particular.
"I thinks you will," replied a new third voice. "What's you got in that sack? We be taking that for starters."
"I think not. Now stand back." Kyrus pulled his cutlass from its scabbard. He gave a quick glance at his shoulder and could see the runes clearly, even through his tunic, glowing with ether. Kyrus drew in a bit more ether and funneled it into the ward, making sure it would have all that it could need in what was clearly looking like it was going to become a fight.
"Oh-ho, this one has some fight in him," the first voice called out,
now clearly visible even in the scant light. He was a smallish man, his bald head reflecting the starlight, and he was dressed in dark work clothes. He looked like a longshoreman. Kyrus heard blades being drawn all around him. He spun about to see that the ring of men around him was drawing closed.
"Now why not set that sword down and hand over the sack, and whatever else you got on you?"
the first man said, clearly not asking despite the phrasing of his statement.
"No man has crossed blades with me and lived," Kyrus bluffed,
trying to manage his best impression of Roshan Solaran. He could not help but think that if the demon warlock had been present, these ruffians would have already been washing the cobblestones with their lifeblood.
"Sure, I heard that one before," the first man said, obviously the leader of the group. "Bag him. We can sell him off to that Hurlan merchant ship that's short on oarsmen."
The ring of ruffians responded at once, approaching from all sides. Kyrus was holding the weapon correctly, as Brannis had learned to wield a sword, but again his brawnier counterpart's training failed him. The first time one of the ruffians tried to hack at him, he blocked the blow full on, and his sword was smashed back into him. The second strike, from behind him, he had no time to even attempt to parry, and the ward absorbed the blow. By the third strike, a third man had also closed to arm's reach and join in as well. Kairos managed to parry one blow to the side before the other nicked him in the arm, stopped thankfully by his ward, and managed to recover in time to slash back and catch one of his attackers across the chest. All pretense of proper sword-fighting technique blew away like a fog before a gale, and Kairos lashed out at any exposed limb or body he could find, trusting in the ward to deflect any blows and his ether vision to keep an eye behind him.
What the? I thought I'd got him. Hey, what gives?
His opponents began to catch on that there was something not right. Each blow they landed seemed ineffective. It was understandable when a single cut did not fell a foe, especially one who might have leathers on beneath his comically oversized tunic. But too many hits were being landed for their prey to have shown no effect. Finally, one enterprising thug took a new tactic, and with a great swipe, smashed the cutlass from Kairos' hand after parrying one of his less graceful thrusts.
Uh-oh,
Kairos thought as the sword fight became a wrestling match. Men who were intent to take him captive and sell him off as slave labor aboard a ship no longer needed swords to defend themselves and dropped them. Arms grabbed at Kairos, some pulling away the rucksack that he had carried over his shoulder the whole fight, and others latching on to hold him. Someone threw a sack over his head, and all but the ether went dark. With a press of bodies all around him, and none of them identifiable by their source, Kairos was not sure who was the one who had pressed a big meaty hand over his mouth and nose, but it instantly made it impossible to breathe. As Kairos was already beginning to breathe hard from the fight, the effect was immediately dire. Kairos panicked and drew all the ether he could. A moment later, Kairos was coughing and choking, gasping in the smoke-filled air to try in vain to catch his breath. He hastily grabbed the scorched rucksack and stumbled away, picking no direction in particular. All around him, buildings burned, and the ring of buildings closest to him had been reduced to fiery rubble. There were screams and panicked shouting filled the night air as people raced to escape the flames, but not from any of Kairos's attackers, who were now nothing but ash on the night breeze. Kairos sat in his cabin, protected behind two wards now, the doors and his own. The smell of smoke was unmistakable about him, even though the scorched rucksack had been thrown into the bay once he had unpacked its contents. The smell had gotten into his hair and clothing as he had escaped the scene of destruction he had created. He wondered what Davin would say if he had seen him destroy a moderately sized chunk of a city. He wondered what Abelay would think of him if she knew that he had just killed not only 11 men who had threatened his life, which she might easily forgive, but uncounted others who had just happened to be too close by when it happened. Magic was so alien to their view of the world that the fact of his magic use alone might easily cloud their opinion of him. He then considered what Iridan would think, or Rashan. He could not help but wonder, despite his own and even Brannis's better judgment, what Juliana would think of him.
I worry that Abelay and Davin would fear me. Iridan and Rashan would probably applaud me. Juliana, she would make fun of my aim.
Kairos was pulled from his musings by someone stopping outside his door. He had not lapsed back into single vision again since the incident with the thugs, so he could see the figure on the other side of the door by its source. There was a pause for a moment, then Kairos heard a knocking coming from the wall just next to the door.
Word works.
Kairos could not help a small smile at that.
Captain wants to see you,
came the voice of Tawmond, who seemed to be settling into a role as Captain Zane's bodyguard and personal servant.
Very well, I will be along directly, Kairos replied.
Kairos began to sort himself out, taking off the sword belt and tugging at the folds of his clothing to try to air the smell of smoke out of them as best he could.
Now, came the impatient reply from outside his cabin door.
Kairos was sorely tempted to just let the man stew outside while he readied himself, but thought better of it when considering that the captain might be upset with him already, if he suspected that Kairos was involved in the fire.
Kairos opened the door to find Tommen just outside. He glared up at the huge thug without saying anything until Tommen backed away. Kairos strode past him and across the deck to the captain's cabin. Kairos did not think to knock as he opened the door. He found Captain Zane inside, along with Stalyart. They were looking over papers at the captain's desk. Denric looked up at his entrance and gazed testily at him. "Close the door, Mr. Regiland, and see that we are not disturbed," he called out to Tommen, who had followed Kairos into the captain's cabin. When the door had been closed, he turned to Kairos. "Is this how it is going to be? First night in port and you bring down hellfire in the middle of the streets? If they connect this back to us, we will be lucky to escape with our lives." "I was attacked in the streets. I tried to fight them off with a saber, but, well, I'm not much good with one. They disarmed me and grabbed me. The rest was just a reflex," Kairos explained.
"Reaction? You cast a hellfire spell and call it a reaction? You cannot..."
"No, I just hurled fire. I do not know any real sort of war spells. I mean, I want to someday, mind you, but it may not be easy to just stumble across someone I can watch to learn from them. I tend to stay away from battlefields," Kairos said.
"No, just no. I refuse to believe you did that just fire hurling," Denric protested. "Firstly, you would have charred yourself to a husk from the inside, channeling that much ether through you raw like that. Secondly, you could not have caused that much destruction.
By the waves, boy, we felt that here by the waterfront. I was in the man-eating shark buying ale for every worthless wretch I could find, hoping to find a few pearls among the oysters, and everyone took note of it. The building shook."
"It was very loud, Mr. Hinderdale, and we see smoke black out the stars in that direction," Stalyart added.
"I was scared," Kairos protested weakly.
"Well, one way or another, just think of not leaving the ship until we shove off. Remember that Cadran behavior we spoke of? Consider this sort of thing added to that list. I shall not have you burning down half of every port city we stop at," Denric said.
"Well, then, teach me something easier to defend myself with. You said you would teach me magics as I needed them. If this is not evidence enough that I need some spells to defend myself with, I do not know what would be," Kairos answered back, growing a little bolder. Something was beginning to dawn on him. "If it was not for the ward protecting me, I likely would have died tonight."
"They are called shields, not wards. Wards are for protecting objects," Denric corrected him.
"Are they?"
Kairos asked. Denric looked at him suspiciously. Kairos watched for the telltale sign of a sorcerer losing himself into the ether and saw it, followed shortly by a look of surprise on Denric's face.
"What is it, Captain?" Stalyart asked.
"This fool had a ward tattooed into his arm," Denric told him. "Mr. Hinderdale, you do know that thing is going to eat into your own source, do you not?"
"What?"
Kairos was shocked. He had not considered that there may be side effects to the protective ward on his arm. It was the same one he had used to protect the door against physical damage, and the door had seemed none the worse for it. "Wards are hungry things. They weaken over time, but rarely fail completely unless they are damaged. That is because they take ether from nearby, bits at a time only, but enough to sustain themselves. By the same manner, if they are too close to a source, they will drain from that source to keep themselves going. That is why many sorcerers shun warded garments, and if they do wear them, keep the wards away from their skin. You have just attached a leech to your source," Denric said, clearly exasperated with Kairos's rash decision.
"I do not feel it doing anything to me," Kairos protested.
He had not noticed the ward doing anything to his source, and if it was, the effect must have been minuscule. "I admit your source is strong, but be warned. That thing will eat away at you until you rue the day you got it," Denric said. "I'm starting to truly question whether you are worth keeping around.
if this is the sort of decision you are making.
Well, then just remember this. If Captain Zane is going to be the most feared pirate in the Katamic again, Kyrus said, remembering that on a few occasions he had noted that the captain seemed proud of that particular ignominy, you were going to have to overcome the fact that the Navy captured you, and everyone knows it. Stealing a Navy ship might help a little, but having a fearsome sorcerer as part of your crew will help not only your reputation, but also your capability. Do you think you would even have been captured in the first place had I been part of your crew then? If you were rid of me, I think you might not last long.
Denric just raised an eyebrow, not having expected Kyrus to talk back as he had. The old pirate seemed like he knew Kyrus had a point, though. If Denric could keep him reined in, Kyrus would be an irreplaceable asset to the ship. When neither Denric nor Stalyard responded immediately, Kyrus asked, "Will that be all, Captain?"
"Yes," Denric replied slowly. "Yes, I think that will do, Mr. Hinderdale."
With that, Kyrus turned and left. He passed the stoic Tawmond on the other side of the door without saying a word. He knew without having to ask that the giant had heard every word he had spoken to the captain. He doubted that the brute had understood half the things they had discussed, but there was enough that was unmistakable that it would certainly give the man pause to consider before laying a hand on him. When Kyrus reached the solitude of his own cabin, he renewed the ward on the door and collapsed down into the bed, his heart racing.
"Did I just threaten the legendary Captain Zane?" Kyrus wondered. "I think I just did. And I think it just might have worked."
"What do you make of him, Stalyard?" Denric asked his first mate. The clutter of papers on the desk went disregarded. His earlier discussion of the merits of various men vying for places on the crew, names jotted down on those same papers, was set aside.
"I like him," Stalyard stated. "He does not know what he is doing, but he does it anyway, boldly. He could have begged from you forgiveness, made promises, but no. Instead, he tells you that you need him, and threatens you if you toss him off the ship."
"You heard his story about his life in Vaedrus. I am beginning to question parts of it. He seems to know more spells than he is letting on. I still do not believe that he was just fire-hurling when he obliterated that district," Denric said, looking to Stalyard for confirmation.
"I believe him and I do not believe him. Think about you. Here you are a pirate, feared and respected, but not by everyone. In Vaedrus, in Magrin, you are the hero. You fought to free your people from Cadrin. You're loved and honored, and respected by all. Are you not the same man as him? If your places were switched, would you live as a saint, using magic to protect everyone in Harvin from harm? Would Denric Zane be a pirate in Magrin waters? I think your own people would hate pirates more than even the ones in this world," Stalyard said. "In the other world, Mr. Hinterdale says he's a robber of merchants, who kills when he has to, but not all the time, so he does not attract too much attention. Well, what if this robber was not so strong, and lived where he did not need to rob to make money? Maybe he works as a scribe. Maybe that robber takes the easy path of food on the table every day, and no risk of being caught. Then what if that same weak man becomes strong and learns magic? Maybe that weak man learns there is more than meals and safety to be had. Maybe the wolf pup who was raised by sheep grew up and realized it was a wolf all along, that its fangs were not meant for eating grass."
"Interesting theory. You believe him then?"
"No, Captain. That Mr. Hinterdale is a liar. He is changing things in his story. Some of it is true. Some is not true. I think all things you could try to catch him at, he probably tells you the truth. He is Cadrin, because you could ask him to speak it, and he could not fake knowing it fluently. He knows how to use a sword there. We know because you tested him. And he obviously did not learn fencing as a scribe. Maybe some of the rest is true too, but I suspect all of it for now."
"What makes you so sure he's a liar?" Denric asked.
He trusted his friend's judgment, but was curious what made the man so sure.
He cheated us all at cards.
Denric's brow drew together and cocked his head to the side, eyeing Stalyart curiously